Ladies and gentlemen, at approximately 3 a.m. this morning in our city, one human being took the life of another. In our world, acts of violence are not rare. And so my excuse, or I should say my reason, for giving importance to this particular story is my hope that the killer may be listening to me. For I believe that in his progress to the chair, or to the insane asylum, that he has reached a way station where his sick and warped ego demands to be fed with the milk of self-importance. And so, with the consent of a very good friend of mine, who is by way of being a remarkable criminologist, but who has also asked that his name not be credited, I'm going to say a few things to the killer, face to face. Item one. Mr. Unknown, you will not for very long remain unknown. Item two. You're husky. Strong enough to have choked to death this morning a poor school teacher by the name of Laura Kelly. Item three. You are the same killer who last week bludgeoned to death a girl by the name of Judith Felton. You are the lipstick killer. Item four. You read the so-called comic books. Item five. You have dark brown hair. A few strands of your hair were found beneath the fingernails of your latest victim. Item six. You are young. A crime lab examination of your hair reveals that you are approximately 20 years of age. Item seven. You're a mama's boy. Item eight. The normal feeling of love that you should have toward your mother has been twisted into hatred for her and all of her sex.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 99. Yes, next time around we're hitting the big 100. That should be very exciting. It's taken a long time to get to 100, so I am looking forward to whatever happens next time around. I know that Sal does want people to submit questions for me to answer on the podcast about pretty much anything. So please submit questions to McTiddles, McTiddles, @gmail.com. I'll get her to put a little promo together for that later in the podcast. But, yeah, so it is quite exciting, and it feels like quite an achievement to get to that, particularly given that I mostly do this solo with a few very worthy exceptions. So, yeah, things here have been okay. Daylight saving ended this morning, so I've got an extra hour to play with around here, which was getting good because it was getting very, very dark in the mornings. The weather's getting a bit cooler, Sal and the cats and the garden are doing well. I'll just go through a little bit of what I've been watching. I haven't been very meticulous in documenting what I've been watching. I'll give you a tip. And to be honest with you, most parts of the world, you're going to have to download this by the dreaded and forbidden BitTorrent. But there's a TV series from New Zealand called The Almighty Johnsons. It's about a kind of ordinary family in New Zealand who happen to be the reincarnations of Norse gods. It's running in its second season now. The second season is about 5 or 6 episodes in. But I like it. I like it for a few reasons. A, it's better than pretty much anything on Australian television. B, there is some sex and nudity, so it does have that going. It's quite funny. It does do the job well. It's really something for New Zealanders to take great credit for. It's got some fine acting in it. It's got some attractive men and women in it. And it's a bit of fun as well. So I recommend that one highly to people. I'll just say the name again, The Almighty Johnsons, which is not about a whole bunch of porn stars. But anyway, enjoyed that. I've watched the whole first season. It runs about 10 episodes. So it's one of those, it's more English than American in the season length. But it is highly recommended. I did review Quatermass and the Pit for the radio gig with Ivor. And we had a bit of fun with that. So talking through the Hammer thing, talking through the Quatermass thing. Both of us really liked the film. It was quite meaty for us to do. We're doing a trilogy of science fiction films. So the next one I'm going to do when I next record with him, we had to skip last week because they were playing football and all the football commentators were taking up the booths that Ivor normally uses to record in. We're doing Village of the Damned. And then after that, we're going to try to get an American science fiction film from 50s or 60s to play with after that. So that was a bit of fun. I did see an interesting film, a Bud Boudica movie, which is very atypical Bud Boudica, called City Beneath the Sea, starring Anthony Quinn, Marla Powers and Robert Ryan. It's about treasure hunting in the Caribbean. And not a great film, but it's got some, yeah, it's a pretty interesting programmer from the 1950s. And if you're into Bud Boudica's films like Seven Men from Now and things like that, it's worth checking out that one. I did see a Japanese film which will please some of the listeners. I saw Death Kappa, which is a very weird little Japanese film from a couple of years ago, where a kappa, which is a kind of spirit come goblin type elf thing with a flat plate on its head which has to be kept wet, meets a girl who's an unsuccessful J-pop star. And it kind of gets weird. You've got people who are trying to crossbreed kappas with unwilling subjects. You end up with an enormous kaiju fight between various things. And, yeah, it's a very weird little film. It's not very good, but you know, it was kind of interesting, and it's nice to step out of the comfort zone a little bit and watch it, something a little bit unusual. Let's see what else I watched. I watched The Shadow, the 1994 movie starring Alec Baldwin, Tim Curry, Penelope Miller, and a few other people. John Lone's in it as well. And I don't mind it. I mean, I think it's a fairly true adaptation for the pulps and the radio plays and the movie serials of The Shadow from the 1930s. It's got a very nice 1930s feel. Alec Baldwin's pretty good in it. And even though it wasn't successful, and yeah, it was directed by Russell Mulcahy, so yeah, that's never a positive thing. I don't mind it at all. And I kind of, there's a lot of backstory to cram in there, but I think it crams the backstory in quite well. It's got Jonathan Winters in it, of all things, playing a police commissioner. And, yeah, if you haven't seen that one or you haven't seen it in a while, it may be worth revisiting for that. Let's see what else I watched. I did see a film noir, which you can find at archive.org because it is in the public domain, called Fear in the Night, starring DeForest Kelly from Star Trek. Now, it's his first full-length feature role, and he plays a man who has a vivid dream that he's committed a murder, and he wakes up with some bruising around his neck and some other indications that he may have actually committed the murder. Turns out he didn't, of course, but he has one of those great tropes of the cinema at the time, which is the evil hypnotist. And it's based on a Cornel Woolrich novel, just like one of the movies we did last podcast. And low budget, but it's kind of interesting. It's a little bit different. They have some very unusual special effects to denote his confusion and passing in and out of consciousness and things like that. So you can see they were trying to make it better than the money would allow. But if you want to check out a film that you haven't seen before, definitely recommend that one. So that's pretty much what I've been watching, not a lot else. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break now. And when I get back, I haven't even mentioned the movies we're doing. Sorry about that, I'm waffling on about myself. So when I am, everything else falls through. The two movies I'm talking about are 1956's While the City Sleeps and a 1933 pre-code political film from the United States called Gabriel Over the White House. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'll talk about While the City Sleeps.
While the global media is focusing on the aftermath of the global financial crisis, debating on whether global warming is scientifically sound or merely a political stunt, or reporting on citizens around the world toppling cruel dictatorships, I want to know why they're not focusing on the big issues. Is chess a better label than Sun? Did Richard Thompson or Britney Spears do a better version of Whoops, I Did It Again? Is Lou Reed or Van Morrison a grumpier old man? Do you think U2 are a crap band? Do these issues matter in your life? They matter in mine. That's why I host Love That Album, a podcast based around music minutia. Join me, Morris Pushtinsky, as every fortnight, myself and a guest host will dissect a favourite album right down to its bare bones and discuss some of the latest music news. You can find the podcast either on the blog site lovethatalbum.blogspot.com or at lovethatalbum.podbean, that's podbean.com, or just type in Love That Album, or one word, into iTunes. If your heart pumps to the beat of a Keith Moon drum fill, then I'd recommend you see a cardiologist. Failing that, you probably care about music passionately, in which case, join me for Love That Album. And you won't even have to drive your car into a swimming pool.
Okay, let's talk about While the City Sleeps. It's a kind of disregarded Fritz Lang movie. When people think Fritz Lang, they think Metropolis, and some people may remember him from Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. But I kind of like this one. I think it's got a kick-ass cast for a start, and I'll just go through them for you. Dana Andrews, Rhonda Fleming, George Sanders, Howard Duff, Thomas Mitchell, Vincent Price, John Drew Barrymore, Drew Barrymore's father, and Ida Lupino. I mean, you can't get better than a cast like that for the 50s. That's kind of your perfect ace film noir cast. Because you've got Dan Andrews, who was in Laura. You've got Ida Lupino, who was in Roadhouse. You've got Vincent Price, Thomas Mitchell, great character actor. George Sanders, Howard Duff, who was married to Ida Lupino at the time, even though they didn't share any scenes in this movie. I just think the ensemble there is kick-ass good. The cinematographer for the film, who worked with Lang on this one, is Ernest Laszlo. And he's got a pretty fine filmography of his own. And the black and white photography in this is superb. Let's see. He did DOA in 1950 for a start. Vera Cruz, Apache. Looks like he did a lot of stuff with Robert Aldridge. The Naked Jungle, The Big Knife, which had Lupino in it as well. Kiss Me Deadly. In Judgment at Nuremberg, Inherit the Wind. Fantastic Voyage, Airport, That's Entertainment, Logan's Run. Pretty good little cinematographer there. And the film itself is pretty good. I'm not sure whether it comes in as film noir. One of my film noir reference books makes no reference to it at all. But I kind of like it. I think it's right on the tail end of noir. And even though it was very much a mainstream film made by RKO, one of their, before they went tits up. But I'll kind of give you a bit of a plot outline just to let you know what it was. By the way, the bit at the start of the podcast was Dana Andrews from While the City Sleeps. This is from Wikipedia. A power struggle ensues after the death of media magnate Amos Kine, whose corporation has been turned over to his sole heir, his foppish son Walter, played by Vincent Price. Rather than run the company himself, Walter decides to let the heads of department, three divisions of the business, fight it out for control. Their assignment is to score an exclusive on a serial killer who is terrorizing women in New York. The Kine organization's newspaper dubs him the Lipstick Killer. If a resourceful someone can identify him even before the police do, Walter Kine will reward him with the title of executive director. So basically you've got three different areas of the business, one run by George Sanders, one run by Thomas Mitchell, who's the hard-headed newspaper guy, and one of them is run by a third character, James Craig. So basically, it's a bit like King Lear setting the daughters off against each other. But this one is a nice little film noir. John Drew Barrymore plays the Lipstick Killer, a character called Robert Manners, who is all kind of sneering. He kind of dresses in slightly what we'd now consider gay leather gear, with the kind of leather peak cap and the leather jacket and the gloves and all that kind of thing. He may have been one of the archetypes for that particular kind of character. But he's not a very nuanced actor, to be honest with you. He's kind of plays it very broadly, and but he does have a kind of physicality which makes that work. And he's basically, as it says at the start of the podcast, he's a mummy's boy. He's a stock standard, what's now become a stereotype character, but in those days wasn't particularly. You've got to remember, this is 3 years before Psycho came out, which really kind of put the last nail in the coffin of the mummy boy serial killer. And, this film works well. It's got some very, very good dialogue. The screenplay was by Casey Robinson, a fine screenwriter who only did one movie after this, which was an Australian film called Scobie Malone in 1975. But before that, he did a number of good films. He was a screenwriter on Captain Blood for Errol Flynn, Dark Victory, All This in Heaven 2, King's Row, Now Voyager, Passage to Marseille, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, and The Egyptian. So, you know, he had a pretty good career. Came to Australia, retired out here, and wrote Scobie Malone, which was a Jack Thompson police detective procedural film, which was kind of zhuzhed up by adding in lots of nudity and sex and turning it into a fairly serious crime novel into a bit of a joke. But anyway, Casey Robinson, yeah, pretty good screenwriter, had some runs on the board, and I'm saying a lot, sorry about this, it's Sunday and I'm getting a slightly blocked up nose here, so if I sound even more nasal than usual, I do apologise. I've got to say, this is one of Dana Andrews' best roles. He is very good as Edward Mobley, the broadcast journalist who does the TV show and the syndicated columnist. He's won a Pulitzer. He's a kind of, basically he's Ed Morrow. And he's got a really good meaty role in this. He plays the romantic lead because his girlfriend, played by an actress called Sally Forrest, is one of the three people who's vying for this job's secretaries. And they have some nicely nuanced and passionate interactions, which is kind of cool. And Ida Lupino in it, who's playing one of the columnists on the newspaper and who's a bit of a tart, is quite fun. She has a drunk scene with Dana Andrews, which I'll play a little bit of that now because I kind of like it. I like the way they're playing off each other and flirting around. Dana Andrews has got drunk after on his day off, as people did in the 1950s, and is kind of sitting in a late night bar with Ida Lupino's character, whose name is Mildred.
Carlo, we are discussing romance, you know. Of course, I gather we are at the stage of discussing it in rather general terms.
Well, it's something to think about.
You see, Carlo, there is also a physical side to love. And some women are more demanding than others. And some automobiles are blue.
Oh, darling, look. Of course I want Mark to prosper. I want him to be happy. I want him to get the job. But if you should ask me if it's love, I would simply have to say I just don't know.
Oh, when do you expect to find out?
Maybe an hour or so.
Carlo's going to have a busy night.
Just Carlo? Oh, Ed, look, am I attractive to you?
I'm in no condition. But objectively speaking, I would say yes. Very.
Come on in my place.
I would also say that I am a poisonous, black-souled, weak-kneed so-and-so. It's all right. I'll give a cigarette.
Thank you.
So there's a nice lot of dialogue there. They're flirting with each other. They don't end up sleeping together. He's engaged to the secretary, played by Sally Forrest. But he was tempted, and he's kind of has a crisis of conscience about that. And yeah, it's kind of a bit more adult. That's where Lang brings in that European sensibility, that recognition of human nature that was missing from so many other American films, where people were very kind of straight-laced and the hero didn't flirt with other women and get into taxi cabs to snog with them, as indeed Dana Andrews' character Mobley does in this film. But I do like that kind of sophistication that Lang and other people, Billy Wilder did it as well, brought to American cinema, in the sense that they really did realize, yes, you can be a good man, yes, you can do good things, yes, you can be the center of a Hollywood film and have these doubts and ambiguities and problems and flaws and all of that kind of thing. And Casey Robinson working with Lang really did play up to that. There's a lot of infidelity in this film. The wife of Walter Kind, played by Vincent Price, is Rhonda Fleming, who has a scene in a bikini which is quite lovely. And she is having an affair with one of the three men who is vying for this job, and she's kind of playing behind the scenes to try to get him the job. And you know, Walter Kind himself is kind of somewhat disinterested in his wife, so there's an implication that he may have his interests elsewhere, and you get that. Vincent Price could always play that ambiguity very well in a lot of his roles, which is kind of good. I do like Thomas Mitchell, kind of crusty old character actor, playing the perfect newspaper man who is ambitious to get the job and really wants it, but he realizes that things like television and wire services are a threat to the position of newspapers, and as indeed ultimately the internet became and succeeded in overthrowing newspapers. But a really, really fine ensemble. And this is also one of Fritz Lang's films, which is a critique of America and a critique particularly of television. They use the television thing as a cash cow, in a sense. And ultimately, Mobley uses his girlfriend as bait to try to trap this serial killer. They find out a few things about him, where he operates, how he operates. And they set it up so that his girlfriend, who I really should give a name to, I mean, it's not right that I don't do that. Her name in the film is Nancy. So basically he sets her up as bait, and they do ultimately trap the serial killer, and there is a great scene in the Underground Railway where Dana Andrews chases John Drew Barrymore through the subways. It was actually filmed on the Los Angeles subway, even though it's supposed to be in New York. But there are some very well shot scenes of, you know, people lunging in front of trains and that sort of thing, which has been emulated in a lot of movies since then. I'm not sure whether this is the first one to do it, but it's fairly early in the game. And it really does have a nice tension to it as well. Fritz Lang only made one more Hollywood film after this one. And again in 1956, it's starring Dana Andrews as well, so they must have liked working together. A movie called Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. After that, the only films he made as a director were in Germany. And let me just get my details up, because I think they were... Yeah, the Tiger von Eschnapur, Tomb of Love, The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse, and Journey to the Lost City. So they were all in 1959 and 1960. Journey to the Lost City looks interesting. That's that one with... Deborah Padgett wearing almost nothing, dancing with a giant snake. So I've got to find the whole lot of that movie. So if anybody's got a link to that I can follow through, it might be a bit of fun to check that one out. So I'll just play a little bit of Walter Kind, played by Vincent Price, explaining his evil plan to set his department heads off against each other. A plan which ultimately is pretty fucked up and does almost cost the corporation a lot of money in libel, because somebody jumps the gun before proof comes through of that somebody's guilty. There's an alternative suspect for the murders, an old janitor who's played by the guy who plays the old guy in the village in The Magnificent Seven, Vladimir Sokolov. So he looks very different in this film than he does in The Magnificent Seven. But he does bring a nice nuanced role, and I think this is a little bit of Lang bringing a European character actor into this very, very American film. But anyway, I'll play a little bit of Walter Kind explaining his plan to Ed Mobley, played by Dana Andrews.
So you're Edward Mobley.
Deepest sympathy, Mr. Kine.
Sit down.
Thank you.
You're the fellow who wrote the book. Every time the old man got sore at me, which was often, he used to talk about you. Mobley this and Mobley that. I got pretty sick of it.
Yes, I can imagine you did.
Those three who were just in here made their opinion of me pretty plain. Amos Kine's idiot son. I suppose you feel the same.
Frankly, I don't feel qualified to feel any way about you, Mr. Kine.
Other publishers took their sons in and taught them the business. But not him. Till I get the hang of things around here, I'm going to need some help. Not that I don't intend to run things in my own way, from behind the scenes. I've got an idea. It's a great idea, if I do say so myself. I'm going to create a new job. Executive director. Someone to do the actual work. What do you think of it?
It sounds like a step your father would have approved.
My father is dead. This is my plant now. I'm going to get myself a gimmick. Something that will set the three of them scrambling for the new job. What do you think of that?
I'd rather not say.
When I have them dangling on the string, when they realize that I hold their entire lives in my hands, they won't sneer. Now tell me, could even he have thought up an idea like that?
No, never. Anything further?
Not for now.
Then good morning.
Nobody does those fucked up evil characters quite like Vincent Price. Even when he went broad in his acting later in his life, he always had that kind of intelligent malevolence to it, even though he's playing a dumb character in this one. And Walter Kline isn't the sharpest pencil in the box. He does bring a kind of interesting complexity just in the way he uses words, which I really, really like. And everybody in this film looked good. Even Howard Duff playing a stock standard, police detective role, which he then went on to do in television for a number of years quite successfully. It's pretty good. And there are some bits at the police station where Mobley gets the jump on the other reporters who have been standing around for hours waiting to interview the suspect that they've arrested, who turns out to be this janitor who's perfectly innocent. And one of the journalists is the person who nearly fucks things up and gets him into a libel suit. There's some nice stuff where the journos are sitting in a back room playing solitaire, just waiting for the cops to do something. And it's got a kind of keen observation about that kind of person. And you get a bunch of character actors in there doing their bits and their business with that stuff. And it does really work well. And even though it's a mostly a studio-bound film for all but probably the scenes in the subways, it does bring a kind of verisimilitude to it, which I kind of like. I like the fact that even in the kind of patently artificial environment, like a studio-based film, bringing those character touches in knocks down the walls and opens it up a little bit. And that's really a nice thing to have in a film. So there's not much else to say about the film. While the City Sleeps is worth checking out, particularly if you like Fritz Lang cinema. In fact, I'm going to have to find a copy of Beyond a Reasonable Doubt now to watch that as well. And have me a little session of Fritz Lang. But that's about all. Let's see who else is in that film with Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Joan Fontaine, not particularly great. Sidney Blackmer, good character actor. Let's see, Edward Binns is in it. Shepard Strudwick. It looks like they've got a kind of, you know, maybe a lower budget than While the City Sleeps, but I think I will check that one out. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to be talking about a very kind of prophetic political film from 1933 starring Walter Huston, Gabriel Over the White House.
Saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. Sing a prayer for someone I really could care for. And then there suddenly appeared before me the only one my arms will ever hold. I heard somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I look, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Somebody whisper, please adore me. And when I looked, the moon had turned to gold. Blue moon, now I'm no longer alone. Without a dream in my heart, without a love.
That was Mr. B, Billy X Time with Blue Moon. Let's get on and have a bit of fun with Gabriel Over the White House. It's a 1933 pre-code film. And one of the things I was thinking when I was watching this film, before I start talking about it, I'll just let you know this, was how the production code really did diminish American cinema. This film's got some nice touches to it. I mean, there are some problems with it as a predictive political text. There are some problems with it for a number of other reasons, but really the complicated relationships in it, which are a little more adult than you'd see in a movie made 10 or even 5 years later. It's just got a little bit more imagination, a little bit more punch, and a little bit more guts than many other Hollywood films that you would have seen from a later date. And I'll just give the IMDb pricey of this one. When the film opens, U.S. President Judson C. Hamilton, played by Walter Huston, is variously described as a Hoover-like partisan hack or basically a do-nothing crook, based to some extent on Warren G. Harding. He suffers a near-fatal automobile accident and goes into a coma. He has what could be construed as a divine intervention, and he miraculously recovers, emerging a changed man, an activist, politician, and a kind of Roosevelt character. He makes a political U-turn, purging his entire cabinet of big business lackeys. When Congress impeaches him, he responds by dissolving the legislative branch, assuming the temporary powers to make laws, as he transforms himself into an all-powerful dictator. So I'll just play a little bit of Judd Scott at the start of the film, just to give you a bit of an idea about the sort of character we're dealing with in this, what could almost be called a political fantasy.
Did I keep my promise, Judd?
Well, I'm in the White House, and considerably worried.
Why?
When I think of all the promises I made the people to get elected.
Oh, you had to make some promises. By the time they realize you're not going to keep them, your term will be over.
Oh, thanks for those unexpected votes from Alabama.
Wait till you get the bill for them.
Good night.
Good night, Mr. President.
Good night, Jim.
So basically, President Hamilton is a party hack at the start of the film. And, from our viewpoint, we expect politicians to be corrupt. We expect them to be in the pockets of big business to a certain extent. The kind of media we have now makes us more aware of that kind of thing than perhaps people were in the past. I kind of like the fact that they do start out with a president in this film who is a shit. And even on the night of his inauguration, somebody turns up on his doorstep.
Miss Malloy, is that correct?
Miss Pendula Malloy.
Miss Malloy, the president's had rather a trying day.
Yes, I know. Inaugurations are very trying.
Lord, well, may I ask what it is you wish to see the president about?
About Miss Pendula Malloy.
Yes, of course. Well, if you'll have a seat, I'll notify the president you're here.
So nice seeing you here, Mr. President.
Nice being here, Miss Malloy. You two have gotten acquainted by this time, I suppose.
Yes, indeed.
Beak, this is Miss Malloy.
How do you do, Miss Malloy?
Miss Malloy is going to be your assistant. You don't mind, do you?
Not at all.
He's very rigid, but I like him.
Anything else, Major?
You may call me Pendy, if I may call you Beak.
Of course.
Good night, Beak.
Good night, Pendy.
So with no fuss at all, Pendy, who is the president's mistress, becomes the confidential secretary to the president. It's quite an interesting approach and not something that you really expect from a Hollywood film of the 1930s. Ultimately, Beak and Pendy, Beak being the assistant to the president played by Franchot Tone, who years later played the villain in Phantom Lady, the film where we talked about last podcast, but in this one he's kind of playing the romantic lead in a sense, and a very kind of interesting and upright character, which is quite a contrast. So the president's driving a car. He overtakes and outruns his motorcade escort and crashes the car, goes into a coma, and wakes up deciding that he's going to do things about the problems of America. You've got to remember, this is 1933. America's in the Depression. Millions of people are out of work. They've got the problem of Prohibition, which wasn't repealed until 8 months after this film was released. And the problem of gangsters, which, of course, is exacerbated by Prohibition of alcohol and the illegal alcohol trade. So the president wakes up and has an epiphany, decides he is going to make a difference. He does a bunch of different things. He decides he's going to create an army of construction from the unemployed men who are marching on Washington. And basically, under military discipline, he does a lot of the things that very soon afterwards Roosevelt did, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, did to create jobs in Depression-era America. And in fact, it's a kind of thing that has happened in Australia during the global economic crisis. Australia put a lot of money into construction of school halls and other infrastructure projects, and has kind of seen us through the global financial crisis a lot better than a lot of other countries because of that. Not very popular with certain right-wing people, but it has occurred. So there are echoes of this film in contemporary society, both in Australia and in America, which is really interesting. It, similar times, and this film does something really, really odd. Now, the film's production, it was an MGM film, and Louis B. Mayer hated it when he saw the end of the film, saw the film at, after it had been released. He didn't see it before it was released, but he saw it when it was released. He was not happy about it. William Randolph Hearst apparently had some input into the making of this film for some odd reason. And basically what happens is that President Hammond starts a benign dictatorship, in a sense. They arrest and execute gangsters. They privatize and re-legalize alcohol consumption, so that the government has control over alcohol. They basically threaten the entire world with air bombing of their navies unless world peace is achieved, and all sorts of other things which we know are not going to work. And you've got to remember, 1933, this is just as Hitler is hitting it big in Germany and getting into power and the burning of the Reichstag and all those other kind of things. So basically what he does is he gets all of the ambassadors and all of the world leaders onto a boat and shows them a display of American air power, which eventually leads to what's called the Hammond Concord and essentially world peace. Now, we know this doesn't work long term. We live in a slightly different world than this movie envisions for 1933. We know, yes, it's okay that governments may disarm and things like that, but it doesn't stop one guy with a backpack full of dynamite making a difference. But it's really an interesting movie because it looks at world issues as they were at the time, the prohibition, the unemployment, gangsters, and offers, maybe it's a cautionary tale of the simplistic answer, in a sense, the simplistic answers that this weird political fantasy portrays. It's a very strange film in a lot of ways. Now, I'll just play another soundbite from it. This is Judd Hammond after he comes out of the coma and decides he's going to make a difference in society.
Am I late?
No, you're not.
What's all the rush about?
I don't know myself.
Well, why didn't he see us before? We've been waiting for him for 2 weeks.
Yes. Don't forget, Judd's been a sick man.
Now, boys, let me handle this situation.
All right.
I've known Judd longer than any of you. He's been a very sick man, and we've got to humor him.
Yes, but we've got to think of the party.
Well, no matter what happens, the party comes first.
Yes, sir.
President.
Well, nice to have you back.
These are meant all condolences. Conserve your sympathy for the people of the United States who are in dire need of it. Sit down, gentlemen.
We're confronted with an ugly situation, Judd. A lot of things have come up since your accident.
Yes, I know.
I mean the Army of the Unemployed.
Bronson and his gang.
Yes, I know. They're getting ready to march on Washington, a million strong.
We didn't think you knew.
Naturally.
I call on you as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. Give me authority to mobilize and keep these ruffians in their camps.
You want to declare war?
We've got to uphold the law.
What law?
Something must be done at once or this armed mob will descend on us. Run riot all over Washington.
Every citizen of the United States should be ensured the elementary necessities for keeping life within his body. This cabinet, every member of Congress, each office holder, is answerable directly to the public conscience. Gentlemen, I refuse to call out the army against the people of the United States.
What are you talking
about? And I refuse to accept that.
Discussion on this subject is closed.
Now be careful. I might resign on you.
Your resignation is accepted.
Oh, well, now, wait a minute, Judge. I was only suggesting...
Your resignation is accepted. You have my permission to withdraw.
This is a weird political fantasy, and one of the things that people have made parallels with is between this president in the film and George W. Bush, because there are some parallels between Bush and Hammond, which are interesting. He's a party hack. He isn't all that bright at the start, and to be honest with you, there's no real strong evidence that anywhere in the film he's a particularly intelligent man. There's a lot of speechifying and things like that, but the plans he comes up with from our 21st century viewpoint are dangerous and simplistic, which gives this film an odd tone these days and really makes it a bit worrisome. It, from our viewpoint, it's a little bit, what the fuck were they thinking? But nonetheless, it's a very interesting and entertaining film. They do have a gangster who's a kind of an immigrant guy. He's got slick back hair and a pencil mustache, and he acts kind of, in an odd way, a lot like the head of a major corporation. Unfortunately, it's not perceived that way by the authorities. But then this gangster also acts like a domestic terrorist. He kills the leader of the army, the unemployed, that's marching on Washington in a drive-by shooting, and blows up one of the government sanctioned liquor stores. The first one that's opened is bombed, basically. And at the climax of his part of the story, he's in one of his warehouses and surrounded by kind of armored cars with machine guns and cannon on them from the newly formed federal police. And basically they bomb him into submission, arrest him and execute him without due process. They do it as a military tribunal rather than as a court of law kind of thing, because he's got a lot of lawyers, he's got a lot of money, he'll get away with it if it does go to a court of law. And that's not too dissimilar with some of the things that were done after September 11th, which makes for some uncomfortable but interesting parallels. It's a really predictive film in some ways, and not too far away from certain uncomfortable past realities. That longing for a simplistic answer to some very complicated and heartbreaking questions is evident both in this film, in the George W. Bush presidency, and also in a lot of the rhetoric coming out of certain right-wing people who are running for president in America at the moment. That longing for simple answers and that pandering to what is perceived as what the masses want is very much evident in this film. It's really, really interesting for that particular reason. And please don't perceive that I'm trying to take the piss or dismiss American politics. There are aspects of this kind of political manoeuvring that exist in Australian politics as well. There are the cowboy party people. There's a guy in Queensland called Barnaby Joyce who has the possibility of becoming, if there's a change of government, the Vice President of Australia. And this guy is a fucking cowboy hoon. He is not the sort of person you'd let run a car wash, let alone a country. So Yeah, there are parallels that can be made between a number of different political systems and this film, which makes it really interesting. Walter Huston is fantastic in the role. I liked him in a lot of films that he did. Of course, everyone references The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but I liked him in a film called Dodsworth. He did playing in a retired industrialist. Anything he did was really interesting and a very fine actor. Of course, his son John Huston was an actor and director, and his grandchildren Angelica and Danny are to this day fine actors. So over a century of this family acting and doing really well at it, because Huston started on the stage around a century ago. So, if you haven't seen Gabriella of the White House, I know that TCM show it sometimes, both here in Australia and overseas. And it's a weird little film, but really interesting, and it shows that at a desperate time in American history, previous to the current desperate time, that reaching out for easy fixes and simple answers and that ability to dismiss the rule of law by changing the law. So that's about all I can say on that one. It's worth seeing and it's worth evaluating and thinking about. So I'm going to take a break now and do some feedback, and then after that, the next time you hear me will be in podcast 100. That was Jet City by Sex Bomber, just to do a change of pace. So on to the feedback. Got a couple of pieces of feedback. And the first one is from our old friend Morris from the Love That Album podcast.
Good evening, Terry. Or good morning, or whatever time it is that you're listening to this MP3. I hope you're well, and I hope that you're anticipating with much excitement the imminent arrival of Paleo Cinema episode 100. As you are playing this, it's hopefully episode 99. I just wanted to send you this MP3 just to make mention of something that I was thinking about while I was listening to episode 98 in particular, with reference to the film that you mentioned, Panic in the Streets, directed by Alia Kazan and featuring 10 Mostel. I thought it quite amusing that Zero Mostel ended up working with Elia Kazan, who had hired him despite his communist associations at the time of the McCarthyist House of Un-American Activities Committee. It reminded me of a film that I've probably written in and told you about how much I've enjoyed before, the film from 1976, The Front, starring Woody Allen, but not written or directed by Woody Allen, a favorite film of mine. And it just reminded me that, you know, Zero Mostel, I'm wondering if ostensibly he played a character not too dissimilar to himself, although quite fortunately the real Zero doesn't meet the same fate as the character on the front, not to give too much away to those who may not have actually seen the film. I also wanted to briefly make mention of a film that I've watched in the last couple of weeks. I went and bought myself a 4-DVD box set of Sam Fuller films, and one of those films was Pick Up on South Street. And while we're still keeping in the House and American Activities McCarthyist era, I'm wondering whether Sam Fuller was a director who might have had the similar sort of sympathies as Elia Kazan. And bearing in mind, I'm asking this question out of total ignorance. Richard Widmark plays a pickpocket who steals a microfilm that is of great importance to a communist element, obviously meant to be seen as the bad guys in this film. A number of the other characters end up espousing sentiments against anyone perceived as having communist sympathies. I guess that, you know, this film might be a product of its time, but I'm just wondering, you know, could you tell me a little bit something about Sam Fuller? Was his sympathy with Joseph McCarthy? Was he like Elia Kazan? Did he rat out any names to the House of Un-American Activities, or did he just happen to know where a good story was a good story? Anyway, be grateful for any information you can provide to enhance my enjoyment of said film. All right, I hope you're doing well. Hope everything's well with you and Sal, and her health is okay. Look forward to episode 100. I'll speak to you soon. Cheers.
Yeah, hey, Morris. I do know a bit about Sam Fuller. I'm pretty sure I did pick up on South Street on a previous podcast. Fuller was basically, he started out as a newspaper man and worked up from a very early age as a newspaper man. So his whole idea was story above all else. And for some reason, he seemed to dodge the bullet of the House Un-American Activities Committee, even though he had friends who were a bit lefty and all that sort of thing. But one of the other things that was defining for Fuller was he was at when the Allies reached one of the prisoner of war camps, one of the concentration camps during World War II. He was attached to one of the people, one of the groups that actually freed up this camp, and he saw all of the ovens, and he saw the starving people, he saw what the Nazis had done, and it was a very important influence on his work. And he had a very visceral knowledge of just what human beings were capable of. In fact, there's a bit in one of his films about it as well, where some soldiers are freeing up a camp, and you don't actually see what they see, you just see their reaction to it. So, Fuller, great director. I mean, any of his movies, 40 Guns is terrific as well. A really interesting spin on the Western. He did a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, Shock Corridor, of course, The Naked Kiss, both of which I've talked about in the podcast. And, any Sam Fuller movie you get, even all the way through to White Dog, his last film, is really interesting and unique as well. Nobody did stories the way that Fuller did. And any Sam Fuller movie you get is going to be very much worth your time. And I've got a lot of time for him. I really should do 40 Guns at some stage on the podcast, because there's a lot to say about the sexual politics of that film, which make it even more interesting for a 1950s black and white Western. But yeah, I'm looking forward to 100 as well. It should be fun. I'm not sure what's going to happen, how much feedback I'm going to get from people and that sort of thing. But whatever it is, we'll run with it. And before I go any further, I should mention what I'm going to be doing for 100. I'm looking at the first two James Bond films. I'm going to be looking at Dr. No And I'm going to be looking at From Russia With Love and having a bit of fun with those. So I'll go back to something that's a lot of fun. A lot of things have been said about them, so I'm not sure how much new I can bring to the game. But I really want to give that a go and indulge myself upon the centenary edition. So thanks, Morrison. Thanks for all your support during the podcast as well. I do appreciate every bit of it.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita, and I am calling you while I'm on the road, which is probably the best time that I always seem to call you. I was coming back from one of my trips to see my folks in Oklahoma, and that's when I always play catch-up, listening to my backlog of Paleo Cinema episodes. So you make the time pass by quickly, and just calling here with as I'm in southeastern Kansas with just a quick message. First of all, to say I'm loving the show as always. And I'm getting ready to listen to the next episode on my podcast or my iPod, but I just got done listening to the Pleasure Seekers Valley of the Dolls episode. So I'm a little behind. But the first thing I wanted to mention was a while back I made a comment that Zom scared me. You know, I want to retract that because in listening to the Pleasure Seekers episode, I think that I finally get Zom. I really do. You know, and I want to say that I thoroughly am now on board with Zom. I really, really enjoyed the last episode of the conversation. He is a true mountain of movie knowledge. I often get told that I'm a mountain of movie knowledge, but I want to say that in comparison, I'm a speed bump compared to him. So, really enjoyed you guys kind of conversing, and I would definitely want to hear more of those episodes in the future. And with that, I want to throw some useless Jean Tierney trivia your way, because you mentioned her numerous times in the episode. My sister and her husband live in Topeka, Kansas, which is about 2 hours northeast of Wichita. It's the state capital of Kansas. And they live in a home that used to be owned by the Menninger Hospital. The Menninger Hospital is a well-known mental health facility in Topeka. And back in the day, they used to own homes throughout Topeka, kind of outpatient, you know, places where people who weren't the most severe cases would have an opportunity to live in a normal house and recover. Jean Tierney suffered a nervous breakdown years ago, before the end of her career, I do believe. I'm not exactly sure when, but I do know that she had a nervous breakdown at one point. And she lived in the very house that my sister owns now. That's where she recovered from her nervous breakdown. When they bought the house, they were told this, and they even know the room that she lived in. And it's actually the upstairs guest bedroom now that my sister calls the Jean Tierney room. It has a little glossy 8x10 picture on the nightstand. So, yeah, there you go. My sister owns the house where Jean Tierney once lived when she was recovering from a nervous breakdown. How about that for some useless movie trivia knowledge? And I bet you no one else knows that out there. Now you do. And now you're all the better for it, I'm sure. You know, I don't have anything to report on movies I've been watching because, quite frankly, I haven't watched anything of note. Last month or so, I've been catching up on shows on my DVR, and I'm just now starting to dive back into some movies. Last night, I did watch The House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. I have seen that movie a million and one times, but Vince and the gang over at the B-Movie Cast are doing Vincent Price Month, and so I'm going to be revisiting some Vincent Price classics, and that's the first one they've got up and coming, so I just wanted to rewatch it again last night, and I loved it, as always. Beyond that, I'm getting ready to dive back into some Akira Kurosawa films, which is interesting, because you mentioned that in the last episode. I'm kind of a late bloomer to Akira Kurosawa myself. I've got a nice stack of films, most of them samurai, but I do have some of his other films, and I'm just now diving into those. You know, I've done some hit and miss stuff recently, and I'm getting ready to watch a few more. So, kind of cool that you're mentioning the same thing. Other than that, I really haven't seen anything outstanding lately. I've seen some okay stuff, but not worth mentioning. And I'm going to leave you with that. I'm loving the show, and thank you for helping this time in southeastern Kansas on these lonely, desolate roads go by a little bit quicker. I don't think I'll be making this trip too many times. This past visit, my mom and dad are now both 80 and have finally agreed to move closer to, in fact, actually they're moving to Wichita, the Wichita area. My dad had a bit of a health scare weeks ago, and they both agreed it's time to move before.
Richard's phone kind of cut out there. It got very fuzzy and unlistenable for about 30, 40 seconds after that. But thanks, Richard, for the feedback there. You're going to send us a photo of the Gene Tierney room, I think. We really need to put that up on the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and put it up there as a shrine to Gene Tierney. Yeah, her nervous breakdown was really unfortunate. I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but she did get German measles while she was pregnant during World War II by doing a USO kind of meet and greet down at the Hollywood Canteen. And one of the women who came up and saw her came out and shook hands with her while that woman had German measles, even though she was supposed to be in quarantine, and gave her German measles, which caused great deformities in her child, and that kind of started Gene Tierney on that downward slope of depression and things. So, yeah, it's she had an unfortunate life, but a great talent. But apart from that, yeah, I'm glad you're listening to it. I'm sorry you're not going to be listening as much as you can on the road because your parents are moving closer. But I'm glad that they're being looked after and they're moving closer to the people they love. It's always a good thing. Vincent Price movies. It's amazing. The more Vincent Price movies you see and the kind of range of Vincent Price movies that you encounter, you really do get the idea of how good an actor he was. And he wasn't just an actor as well. He was an art educator. He was a gourmet chef. He had a lot of different talents there, and he just had a great gusto for life. He really did embrace life and run with it. His daughter's biography of him is really good. Vincent Price, the daughter's biography by Victoria Price, is a lot of fun. It goes into some of their relationship and the ups and downs of that, and it's quite a good document as well on being the daughter of a movie star and a celebrity, and how that does affect a person's life. So ultimately her and her father reconciled and things, but they found all sorts of hidden artworks when he died. No going through his stuff, they open up a folder and find like Matisse drawings and things like that. But yeah, Vincent Price, he's always on the pantheon for any podcast I know of really cool guys who brought a lot to movies, even when the movie didn't particularly deserve it. As for Zom being scary, no, I don't find him scary at all. He and I talk before and after we Skype on podcasts, and he's a lovely guy. He loves his dogs very much. He loves his comic books. He loves women. He's a tremendous asset to this podcast whenever he chooses to pop in and have a chat. And over our interactions on Facebook and otherwise, I consider him a friend. So, no, Zom's not scary. He's eccentric, and I'd never take that away from him. But scary, I never found him that way. I mean, yeah, well, if I was on a raft, maybe, and we're running short of food, I'd be looking sideways at him. But apart from that, no trouble at all. Anyway, I've got another voicemail, and I'll just play that one now.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita. Two voicemails, back to back. How exciting. Hey, I just got done listening to the Panic in the Streets episode. Awesome, as always. And I think I've got my Saturday night double feature lined up. I usually try to watch kind of a double feature on Friday and Saturday nights, and I think tonight I'm going to hit two podcasts with one stone. I'm going to watch a Vincent Price movie in honor of what Vince and the B-Movie cast are doing with Vincent Price Month. I'm going to watch something that they're not going to review, but it's been a movie I've wanted to watch for a while, and that's the movie Laura with Vincent Price. So, and then I'm going to watch Panic in the Streets. The fact that that is on YouTube is perfect timing. I just got a new thing for my DirecTV satellite, is I can access YouTube off of the internet through my DirecTV connection. So basically, I can watch YouTube videos through my DirecTV box on my big screen TV, and the quality is really good. So Panic in the Streets and Laura, going to be my Saturday night double feature. So also wanted to comment real quick on your new podcast, the Martian Drive-In. That sounds awesome. I think that's really a cool idea. You're still going to be doing the same number of podcasts. You're just going to be alternating, and I think that's a cool deal. So I look forward to listening to what you got planned for the Martian Drive-In podcast. Definitely, that's probably, horror, sci-fi movies are my guilty pleasure, and I tend to watch more of those than probably anything else. But every now and then, I need to switch gears and watch something like Laura or Panic in the Streets to kind of both cleanse the palate and just continue to see in my very long list of movies that I want to watch. And that list continues to get longer and longer, thanks to guys like you and Vince and your podcast expanding my movie horizon. So look forward to hearing what you got planned for that. And, loving the show, and take care. We'll talk to you soon.
I was right. I was Richard calling back. Yeah, Laura and Panic in the Streets, good combination, beautiful black and white films, a lot of fun, and a lot better than watching Twilight. But then what isn't? I mean, I think self-piercing your own scrotum with a Black and Decker drill would probably be better than watching Twilight, but that's a personal opinion not shared by certain females. But anyway, yeah, thanks very much for that, Richard. Yeah, Vincent Price again, he's definitely on our pantheon here. He really does bring his A-game to things. But then who else would I put on the pantheon? Christopher Walken, even though he's not particularly paleo cinema material. I love Chris Walken stuff. Let's see, I like Robert Forster. Really cool stuff. I'm going to have to do Alligator in the Martian Drive-In at some stage because I consider that one of his good films. Also, yeah, things like Medium Cool, Jackie Brown, a whole bunch of different stuff. I really have a lot of time for him. There are so many good actors, but I don't see many up-and-coming good ones in that sense. There probably are some, and there are probably people who will develop into this kind of cool, eccentric and interesting thespian. But let me know who you think are the up-and-comers who are going to take over that kind of gonzo mantle. I don't think Ryan Gosling will, because I'm yet to be impressed. I did see Drive, and I acknowledge the script was good and the acting by other people were good, but Ryan Gosling, I'm yet to be convinced. But anyway, that's about it for this time round. I'm going to do a shout-out to everybody who is cool in the podcasting world. Morris, of course, over at Love That Album. The guys over at Shooting the Pooh podcast, which people should check out. Writer and the Critic, Kirsten and Mondi. Also, Galactic Suburbia, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Definitely one of the best there is. Amicus Podcast, Brian and his cronies over there hitting the hammer and the amicus. Let's see, the B-Movie Cast, of course. Silver and Gold as well. If you get on the Silver and Gold Facebook page, be aware you may see mutilated body parts still attached to people and some things you wish you could unsee. I'm not sure where these guys get them from, but I don't particularly want to know where they get the pictures from. But anyway, and all the other good podcasts we know, Metal Mikey, Average Action Attraction, etc., Girls on Film. I haven't had something from them lately. I'm not sure if they're still going. But anyway, take care of yourselves. I'll be back in 14 days' time with number 100, and we're hitting the 007. Dr. No and From Russia with Love. Very, very cool stuff. And please, feedback. Paleo-cinema.com is the website. cultguru@gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. There's only one. And enjoy yourselves in the meantime. Enjoy your film watching and talking about it with your friends, sharing the love, burning copies, whatever you need to do to share that love of cinema with your friends. And I will be back and I will be celebrating. I'm going to have to find lots and lots of sound effects of people having parties. Anyway, take care of yourselves and I'll be back soon. Bye.